Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Like a modern day War of the Worlds. Employment numbers are in. We'll talk about that. Special committee on trying to cut the deficit is coming to a roadblock. And we have guests today, great guests. We have both Frank Curzio from Stansberry Research and Mike Rosenberg from Bloomberg. All this and much more coming up on episode number 237 for the first week of November 2011. Well, yeah, here we are. It is November, and there is no shortage of news. And we're going to talk about that in a minute, how to react to the news and what to do about it. This is Andrew Horowitz, and thank you so much for joining me today and for putting in your votes for the podcast awards. We're going to know the results this week. I don't know. Maybe we have a chance of getting a little something there. But there's some stiff competition, some really great shows out there. And for all of you who really enjoy the opportunity to listen to podcasts, a great medium for sharing ideas and getting information out there. Well, there's some great names on that list, on whether it's business or social or exercise, etc. Check it out over at Podcast Awards. Anyway, I did want to talk to you about what is going on for just a few moments before we get to our guests. We have a couple of them on today. We have also next week, we have Das coming back by popular demand, and we're also going to have Tom McClellan. So we have two guests lined up for next week as well. And they're going to talk about hopefully some of the things that are going on in Europe. That's Das's specialty. And he is going to talk to us about the whole issue in Greece. And, of course, Tom McClellan, the issues about, you know, looking at, well, what are the markets telling us aside from what the news is saying? Now, I wanted to mention that because you remember, of course, War of the Worlds, not the modern one, throw that away, the old story where there was this radio show, right? And the radio show was put out there, and people panicked because they thought there was really aliens coming. They thought there was this incredible situation where the radios were reporting this story, but little did the people know that there was these aliens coming, and everybody panicked. I mean, there's mass panic. It's crazy. But in those days, maybe it was a little bit more difficult to get information around, and there was less ability in some areas to get confirmation. But, you know, people panicked, and they panicked without seeing any actual indication of an alien. They panicked without any confirmation, and they just went cuckoo. It's kind of what's happening these days in the markets. Every news item is being just sold or bought at, you know, in crazy levels. Markets move 1% when Greece is going to accept their bailout and boost. Down 1% when there's going to be or 3% actually, when there's going to be a referendum. It moves up 0.5% when there's a discussion that, that China's economy is slowing or increasing. Floods, earthquakes, tsunamis, riots, oil prices. And it's all news-driven these days in an incredible manner. Now, why is that? I mean, how could the news have such an effect on every stock out there? Is it this massive population explosion of people that are sitting by their computers every single day just waiting for the news to hit and then pressing the buy and sell in, you know, kind of together in this incredible herd mentality? No. Is it, reaction of, you know, to something really happening and people panic? Well, no. It's the futures machines. It's the ability for the hedge funds to move in and out and create volatility in big waves when these news items occur. But moreover, it's also the lack of, I think, retail participation holding up the markets. A lot of investors are fed up. What do they need this for? What do you got to get involved in this for? What's the point right now? Let it just dissipate and then I'll get involved. But right now it's Very similar to what happened back in the War of the Worlds. We're not really seeing all the evidence. We're just speculating on what it's going to be. We know there's problems in Europe, yes. But you know what? When we hear news that somebody's resigning or somebody is going to be changing their mind, we don't have confirmation, but yet there's reaction. So what I'm going to tell you to do right now is something probably that I've never said before and that I don't want you to do permanently, but just for the short term at least, when we are going through these kinds of crazy moments in the markets, I want you to turn off or at least limit your access and your reaction to the news until there is some kind of, I guess, conclusion. There's just no reason. There's no reason to get all uptight and upset and worried, and because we don't know exactly what's going on, because the governments of Europe and the finance ministers are really twisting it and turning it to their advantage whenever possible for political gain. Same thing happens here. So I want you to really think about that for a second. And if nothing else of the message of this particular show, I want you to think about War of the Worlds, the panic, and what's going on now. And then I want you to make sure to keep the news maybe somewhere in the background. But, you know, there's so much coming out that's so negative right now. It really has to shape your opinion. And let's kind of keep the news off to the side. Now, also, I want to mention some news. I just want to mention that the unemployment numbers came in and they were mediocre at best. But, you know, it's somewhat where we expected. Nobody's expecting a big move on the unemployment numbers. So, you know, that's something that we have to keep in mind. And also, I want to mention that the speech by Bernanke last week was pretty interesting. I watched it on the iPad, the brand new Bloomberg application, the TV application for the iPad. Great, great application to watch things on. We're going to talk to Mike Rosenberg in a little while from Bloomberg. I'll mention that to him. But the other thing I want to mention is that if you've been watching the oil and gas plays and a lot of the names in the smaller areas that are doing the fracking and hitting the various regions around the U.S. have been doing very well. Oil and gas and energy. Look at Chesapeake, what they did last week. Gulfport Energy. There's just a lot of really great energy stories right now. And that is really, I think, a wonderful testament to us really getting off of our dependence, the absolute dependence on oil from other places. So that's really a nice thing. I want you to take a look at some of those stocks. All you have to do is pull up like a Gulfport or a Chesapeake and simply just look at the competitors and see what they're doing. And then you could really get an idea of they're volatile, but really the nice earnings that they've had lately. We also profiled Hanson Natural last week, right before the earnings came out. Said, hey, you know what? If they're right on or get close to, the stock will pop and your price target should be this to buy in. Take a look at that over at the Disciplined Investor. We're going to start doing that a little bit more regularly. Also talked about Herbalife. And we're going to also talk about next week a stock. I just want to mention it to you to take a look at. It's Quality Systems, Inc., one of the top fundamental picks, or at least that I've seen across the board on our scoring system. But yet, boy, it fell pretty darn hard last week, but it's basing out here. So we're starting to look at that and to see what's going on there and maybe looking to, you know, kind of nibble into it for our clients. QSII, don't jump into it. Obviously, it's not a recommendation to buy it, but take a look at that. I think it's an interesting opportunity right now at these prices. We're going to really get to the guests sooner than usual because there's two of them, and I want to make sure we stay within a reasonable amount of time. I just want to mention to you a couple of things, and then we'll get right to them. We have, obviously we know that we have the upcoming situation next week. It's going to be kind of interesting to watch over in Greece. But I think that right now the earnings season dying down is going to be rather anticlimactic, even though it's been pretty good. But I think that everything is still ruled by whatever goes on in Greece on a daily basis. So just keep, you know, kind of like I said, your eyes peeled, your ears open, but at the same time, just be careful on how you react to things right now because, you know, for every action right now, there'll be a reaction by the governments to try to stem the problems. I mentioned also that this particular episode is sponsored by GoToMeeting. We've talked about them before. GoToMeeting is a great way for you to keep in touch with, it's whether clients or family or friends, where you want to share some things, whether it's pictures or a meeting, or you don't want to get on a plane and fly somewhere and you know, visit somewhere that may be, I don't know, 10 hours away, 5 hours away, and then you have to pretty much give up a whole day's worth of work to travel. GoToMeeting is very convenient, very inexpensive. You get 30 days free with GoToMeeting just for going over there, taking out a trial, and checking out the full expanse of all the things they have available. Really a great service. Go to GoToMeeting.com and put in the code podcast in the little box, and you'll get 30 days absolutely free. So make sure to check that out. And please make sure, do me a favor, go to and make sure to check out thedisciplinedinvestor.com throughout the week. You have to do that because we put a lot of information up there that's actionable and usable. And make sure you have that in a bookmark. All right, so our first guest today, Frank Curzio, a good friend of mine and a brilliant stock picker, a guy that really understands the inside of markets and economy. And this is the kind of guy that, you know, there's a lot of book knowledge out there. A lot of book knowledge. I'm not going to say that Frank doesn't have any.
Right. Thanks. Good opening.
No. But he's got the street knowledge, and I mean that sincerely. That's important. Being on the beat, being in the trenches, being around the guys that are really, you know, doing the buying and selling is really important. So, Frank, you know, I'm glad you're with us today because a lot of things I want to talk to you about.
Thanks. Glad to be on the show, bud.
Frank's with Stansberry Research, by the way, and we're going to start off, I think, with a discussion of, you know, the big picture of what's going on here, the trading volatility, and, you know, I mean, it's been... Every professional that I know, forget retail, professional is like, what is going on? And why is it going on? What's your kind of take on this whole market movement and the daily or the hourly kind of spikes and, you know, of excitement and letdowns? And, you know, what do you think?
Well, I think a lot of professionals are hedged a lot here. So, you know, it is a little crazy how this market's moving. But let's talk about the individual investor. I mean, how difficult it is for them watching every single day. We're seeing the Dow up 200, down 200, up 200, down 200. Greece is okay. They're not okay. They're getting bailed out. Referendum. I mean, there's different news coming out. I mean, if you're an individual investor, I mean, you and I look at these markets all the time. That's our job. But a lot of these people, you know, they trade on the side or are doing different things. They have other jobs. But you're seeing stocks that report good earnings. They'll be up 3% when you leave. You go downstairs if you want to eat breakfast, or you know, you're at your job. You come back, they're down 15%. You're like, what the heck just happened? So it's really, really, really a crazy market right now. But I think, you know, I've been telling people this strategy. You know, you have to be patient. You have to have some powder on the sidelines. I think that you know, you could see your stocks. I mean, right now, we're looking at you know, a bad PMI number out of China, and you own a material stock, could push it down 10%, 12% in a day on something that has relation to China when they just barely missed a PMI number. Be patient. Try to use this volatility in your favor where you can sit in the sidelines, buy your favorite names. If they go up 20% in a couple of weeks, which we're seeing, sell half. Even if you think your thesis is intact, you think it's going to go a lot higher, that's the market we're in right now. You got to worry about the market we're in sometimes. And you can't really buy and hold here when you're seeing these huge moves back and forth. It's very, very difficult. But that's what I'm telling my clients right now, my subscribers.
I got to tell you something. You know, you say that you went to, what did you say? You went to lunch and it's down 15%? Because, you know, you can go to the bathroom. I'm not talking about the long bathroom break either. I'm talking about just a bathroom break. And honestly, you could see, I mean, a change that's dramatic. You're like, what just happened? You know, what you know, did Papandreou's sneeze? Did Sarkozy, you know, did he say something? And there is a tremendous amount of news. I wonder, Frank, do you think it's possible? I know it's possible, but do you think there's a lot of, we'll call it automation trading going on in the news? Somehow, you know, the iPhone just came out with this or has now embedded the Siri, which is very cool. You could do things like, hey, remind me when I get to the office to call Frank. And it uses the GPS to figure out when I get to the office that day and automatically pops up and says, hey, call Frank. Mm-hmm. How cool is that, right?
Yeah, no.
So cool. There's all sorts of really good things. Like you could say, you know, hey, where can I bury a dead body? And it comes up and says, hey, where do you want to bury it? Do you want a sewer, drainage ditch? Do you want a cave? What, you know, so there's some funny things. But the intuitive nature of voice recognition, do you think they're using that in trading to trade off of news highlights, headlines, and commentary?
Well, it's kind of amazing. I'll share a story with you. And this is a while ago. I mean, we're talking about 3-4 years ago when I used to be at thestreet.com. When I used to send out, we used to send out alerts at Street.com. My newsletter is not alert-based now at Stansberry, but when I used to work for Street.com and Jim Cramer, whenever the alerts used to come out, almost to the second when they were released, there's no way anyone could have got it, read it, and bought the stock. I have no idea. But just the trading systems that are available right now, literally as soon as it went out, the stock would jump by 3, 4, 5, 6, 7%. In less than probably about 40 seconds, you see the stock up 6%. And there's no way anybody could actually read it because the alert is like four paragraphs and you see a recommendation on the bottom. There's no way somebody could actually see it, look at it, type it into a computer. So, you know, the automation is there. It really is amazing, these program trading systems right now. But, yeah, you know, with high-frequency trading, you're going to see a lot of these moves. They have bids and asks all over the place. I hear 80% of these trades I've read get canceled. I mean, there's bids and offers all over the place. So these market moves, once they move up or low, you know, a lot of these things are getting triggered. You're going to see more volatility. But it is really, really difficult for the individual investor right now. It really is. And it's sad because you'd like to be able to buy stocks and hold them for 18 months based on, you know, three or four different catalysts you see. And yet, you know, you're seeing these stocks, especially small caps, which is my area of the market. I mean, they're moving 25-30% on a monthly basis, almost guaranteed right now.
You have 18 minutes is what you have. You know, I don't know if who's more excited when they talk to the other, myself talking to Frank, Frank talking to me, because I know that Frank can talk, but man, he could talk fast when we get on the phone.
Yeah, that's true. You know? We both can, right? I know.
Exactly. All right, let's switch to a couple of things that are going on that I think need to be addressed. The MF Global situation. Now, we can speculate as to what went on there and why Karzain thought that there was just an absolute, you know, or had a disregard for the level of risk or misunderstanding. But now we're talking about the whole idea of maybe there's customer account money that was used and commingled. And also there was now an insider trading scam that's being done or a probe being done because hours before the downgrade, a ton of convertibles were sold. I mean, probably, I think the number somewhere like 70 or 80% of all the convertibles outstanding were sold. Now, that's a little weird, don't you think?
Yeah, it is weird. And there's going to be so much stuff coming out in that company. It's sad. I was just watching CNBC on Friday, and they actually had a portfolio manager on that has all kinds of option positions through MF Global, and he's locked up. And it's like $35 million on the management. He can't do anything. They're like, oh, you know, we're trying to do our best. You know, when you look at the big picture here, and even for the individual investor, which both of our shows are tailored to, our podcast, when you see a guy like Corzine, whether you like him or not, and he's not really high on my list, to be honest with you, even before this. But you're seeing a guy that has the biggest connections in the world, leveraged through the roof, great trader, supposedly used to be a great trader anyway, and still get killed and able to bankrupt this company. It tells you how difficult this market actually is and why, you know, you should have stop losses, why you should be careful. Even no matter how much conviction you have in a stock, you never know. But when a guy like this with all the connections in the world to Goldman Sachs and every place else, it really is a sad story because a lot of individuals get hurt when stuff like this happens. And even like, you know, you're looking at the mid-tier money managers really getting hurt that had their money traded through, cleared through MF Global are really getting hurt here. They don't know what to do. And it really is terrible when you see something like this happen. But as far as you're saying, there's going to be a lot of more bad news coming out, and you're going to see it's going to get really, really ugly, I think, especially over the next month or so.
Hey, hey, hey. Let's go on to something maybe. Well, let's hit one more kind of ugly point, then we'll hit on some of the good or better stuff, okay? Paulson, I saw an interesting article. Paulson, the guy who was the master of the universe, who not only called but actually collected a profit, a substantial profit, on the whole housing meltdown. A lot of people were saying, hey, this is going to happen, but it was very difficult to actually capitalize on it. So this guy goes and he does this great thing, and then he has all these funds and all this money that's attracted to him, and he has big on gold, and he has particular things that are in his fund that is leveraged, and it's also tied to gold. Well, meanwhile, he's down about 46% year-to-date. He comes back in October with a whopping 2% gain. Now, I was scratching my head when I saw that a couple days ago, and said, wait a minute, let me get this straight. How in the world, when the banks and all the companies that he owned were rallying through October, did he only come up with a 2% gain? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, once these funds, especially one that large, you know, I mean, redemptions play into it. And mm-hmm. he did so terrible in the summer months up to September, I'm sure. The outflows coming out of his fund, which probably hurt a lot of his positions. I mean, I'm not too sure exactly what stocks he invests in, but I know when you have billions and billions in the management, and there's about 20-30% of the people that want their money back because of bad performance, he's forced to sell a lot of these positions in October, even though the market's doing good. Again, I'm not too sure of the individual positions, and plus I know he also had a very big position in gold. I believe 25% of his fund was in gold, and he still had that performance. He's done such a great job for such a long time, and the fact that he's just down so much, it's difficult. I mean, again, when we talk to the individual investor, when you see these funds, individual investors have such a great opportunity compared to some of these large fund managers that can't really buy anything you can or jump in and out of positions like you can. When they see the financials getting crushed, they can't sell because
right.
they're going to push a company like Bank of America down another 10-15%. That's how big they are.
Right.
And plus, word on the street gets that, hey, you know what? Paulson's blown out of Bank of America. So what do you think that happens? Everybody jumps on board. So, I mean, maybe that happened. But yeah, with October, with the Russell 2000 up 25%, the market up 20% in 30 days, I'm surprised he was only up 2%.
Yeah, pretty surprising. So let's talk about the whole earnings picture right now, because I know you study that pretty well. By the way, I've been sending you those orange books. You enjoy those? The whole thing where you see?
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Those are great, right?
Yeah, fantastic. Okay.
Bloomberg puts out something called the Orange Book. It's Richard Yamaroni. He puts out something called the Orange Book, which is basically a compendium of the highlights of the earnings calls throughout the quarter. And it ends up being something like 60 or 70 pages by the end. And I got it a few times. I said, I call him Richard. It's just a gigantic amount of all this stuff. I don't know what's, because he keeps on adding to it. So I convinced him to change the colors so that the orange ones are the latest ones, the newest ones.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes it a lot easier, don't you think?
It's basically a recap of a lot of conference calls, which is cool. And you also get that. I think you also have people on your podcast as well. And I don't get paid for saying this, but briefing.com is one of the services I use.
Yep.
That have that updated conference calls, which helps out because they all report within a month period, sometimes five or six in the same day of stocks that you own. So it's good to have that.
Right. So let's talk about the earnings, though, and the conference calls that you heard. There's a lot of margin discussion, a lot of pressure about European. There's a lot of concern about the outlook with that. But generally speaking, earnings have been better than were expected by analysts, which already marked them down, right? But what do you think about, when you look at the number, not from a surprise standpoint, but just, what we've seen so far and how companies are doing.
Not surprising. I mean, I think they're coming in as expected. Like you said, they lowered earnings estimates a lot going into the quarter. But the thing that I like right now is, and I mentioned this to you offline, which has to do with earnings season, is a lot of cyclical stocks have gotten absolutely buried, down 40, 50%. And that's because, we always had the European problems in the summer. But in September, there was, the data that was coming out really indicated that the U.S. could fall into recession. Right now, based on everything released, I just don't see it based on the data. It's not like, I'm a cheerleader for the market or anything. But if you look at anything, manufacturing, retail sales, jobs, it doesn't indicate that we're going to recession. Look at MasterCard results, 23% growth in debit card usage. People spending money that they actually have, that stock's at an all-time high. You're seeing a lot of economic bellwethers, and I'm not predicting huge growth, enormous growth, like we're going to see jobs or more than 2%. But if we don't go into recession, I think a good place to be is in some of these steel stocks. You're looking at chemical companies. Huntsman just reported its best quarter ever as a company. The stock was down 50% before the quarter. It jumped up 20%. I still think that if the company's reporting its greatest earnings ever in the history, it shouldn't still be down 40% from its all-time highs. So as long as the U.S. doesn't fall into recession, you're going to see that a lot of cyclicals, especially on the earnings front, that they're coming in pretty solid. Companies like Steel Dynamics and stuff, that I think that's a great opportunity, especially if you're looking at those earnings.
Yeah, but at the same time, I want to throw something out at you that has been juggling and jingling around my head for some time, and it's something that I just don't know if it's been taken into consideration because you don't hear about it. And that is this. You talked about MasterCard. MasterCard is doing well and came out with great numbers. And you saw Visa with okay numbers. And Verifone, which is another alternative for the payment systems, do well. And, we can go down the list of companies. Now, one of the biggest things that we've seen is that the commentary has been North America has been weak, Europe has been weaker, Asia, Latin America, emerging markets have been stronger. Now, one of the things is it possible, Frank, for the U.S. to show recessionary levels of various manufacturing or employment or a service, and at the same time, companies having good earnings because much of their earnings are derived from elsewhere?
You could see that, but if you're looking at companies like Google, 25% revenue growth year over year. You're looking at companies like Pepsi, 37%.
But Pepsi was all emerging markets. It was flat here.
37% in Europe. You know, so you're looking at a place that's supposed to be like, you know, dead money, right? A 37% growth in Europe. So if you're looking at the details inside of these companies, you know, to answer your question, are we going to see – I don't see any recessionary trends right now. I really don't. I mean, based on economic data, again, I'm not saying that we see more than 2% growth. It's just I don't see two straight negative GDP numbers coming up.
But here's the thing, Frank, here's the thing. You know, you got 30% growth in Europe. You got a 15% probably tailwind on the euro and the currency transaction that went on there, or at least some hedging that they had there, plus, you know, some tailwind. I'm not knocking Pepsi. I'm not knocking any of this. I am just, and I'm saying this in a good way, by the way. I'm saying this in a positive note that you see, like, you could sit back and say, who is buying Tiffany? Who's buying the stones? Well, meanwhile, the $20,000 to $50,000 range of their products are selling at incredible levels. Who's buying the Coach? Who's buying this and that? Well, maybe it's not necessarily this whole idea that, well, we have to have good employment here. We have to have a robust economy here. Maybe if the companies themselves, now, boiling down to very simple math of we buy a company and it may be, I don't want to say exempt, but it may be not totally tied to the fate of the U.S. economy. And if there is expansion going in, look at Chipotle. You wouldn't think Chipotle could raise prices and absorb the higher food costs from last quarter. This quarter, actually, food costs went down and, you know, still do well. Starbucks, the coffee prices have been just through the roof. Mm-hmm. They're still doing well. You know, you go on and on and on down the list, and these are retail discussions, but, you know, you go on and on down the list, and you do see growth in other places because they haven't been there before, number one. There's a tailwind because of currency, and it doesn't really matter what the U.S. may be doing, because even if U.S. just stays stable and they grow out their overall sales everywhere else in the world, that's really good for U.S. companies.
Yeah, which is what you're seeing in Pepsi and companies like Coca-Cola, which are growing outside of the U.S. and not too much in the U.S. So, yeah, I definitely agree with that.
So I think that we have to – I think it's important to – at this point, right now, just at this moment, because a lot of times the fate of the U.S. stock market, like, you know, relies on the fate of the economy, or at least the economic numbers, and we look at unemployment, look at all these things. But you know what? There's a kind of a different thing going on now with this whole globalization, good and bad. You know, the bad is we get the infection from Europe when that stuff goes down. The good is that we also have the benefit of alternative sources of income, kind of like a second job, if you will. If things don't go well in certain areas, we can really, you know, companies can press that. So be careful, I think, when we really are down on, let's say, U.S. economics, but all of a sudden see like, hey, wait, why did earnings come in okay, much better than anticipated, because, you know, things look so bad here. You got to take a much more broader picture of the global economics, I think.
Absolutely. And when you're looking at individual companies, I mean, forget the economy top-down approach. If you're looking at bottoms up, you want to look at the quality of the beat. Are companies able to pass on these higher costs? Also, if you're looking, I mean, a lot of people talk about inflation so much. If you're looking at it before the rally, a basket of commodities, if you're looking at everything from wheat, oil, natural gas, were down 18, 19% before October. They're still down more than 10% right now, which is incredible for companies, even like food companies, that are raising their prices, because those prices are holding and yet their, you know, expenses are obviously going are lower. So you're looking forward and that could benefit earnings. Could that be a consistent trend? I don't know. But when I see a company like Google reporting 25% growth in revenues, or J.B. Hunt reporting huge revenue growth, I mean, J.B. Hunt's one of the largest transportation companies, trucking companies, you're not going to see growth in revenue unless people are shipping more things. I mean, whether that transfers to the bottom line, that depends on how good management is. But I'm just saying, if you're looking at the top line, that indicates people are spending more. And so you really want to look at the quality of his earnings, because you could only cut so much. And I think you and I were on the same page. We thought that they wouldn't be able to cut forever, and they still seem like to be squeezing a lot of every dollar here. But you also want to look at the quality of earnings, and there's still a lot of companies that are doing very, very well out there, like you know, like I said, like a Google that's able to increase revenue, had the best quarter ever. You're looking at Huntsman 2, best quarter ever. So, you know, be careful with the quality of earnings. I think that's something that you and I actually talk about a lot.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. And that's, I think, an important issue that we need to, you know, definitely deal with. All right, let's move on to the idea of a possible new Tepper rally, you know, whereas, you know, you see a performance chase that every dip is being, you know, potentially could be bought. Hedge funds seemingly stayed out whether they're in, it's going to end up that they're right or wrong, but they stayed out of the October rally, and there is a performance chase that usually goes on towards the end of the year. Is that possible this year?
I think it's possible this year. I mean, they might be buying here. They're obviously underfunded. We've read that a lot, but going into October. But, you know, if you're looking on the whole, and I'll bring up back this point again, not to be dead horse here, but, you know, I just think if you're looking at where stocks are, where we're trading at 11 times earnings, I just think this, if you're looking at the S&P trading 11 times earnings, you're going to see stocks trading at 8-9 times earnings within that index. I just think there's a lot of good opportunities out there, and you're going to see, I mean, you're looking at you know, billions of dollars being removed from this market. The most was removed this summer. It was only surpassed by the October to December in 2008. That's how much money was removed from this market during this summer. And if you take that time in December 2008, right after that was one of the best buying opportunities ever to buy the S&P 500, the Russell, or whatever. So there's a lot of money still on the sidelines that wants to come in, like you said, chasing this. But I just think that, you know, you're looking at the 10-year below 2%. You're looking at or at 2%. There's just so many great opportunities out there with companies where you could earn a 3% yield and you have that growth potential. I just think right now, even looking at housing too, I just think stocks are a good alternative right now. There's not really too many places I'd rather put my money.
Yeah, you and Bernanke, by the way. Bernanke said that basically gave the green light to risk assets in his conversation. But I thought that was really interesting. Hey, let's close up on one other point. Last time you were on was back in September. You talked about biotechs. Mm-hmm. You talked about the generic drug companies. You had a couple mm-hmm. of them in mind. You still think this is an area that is hot, could do well, and is yielding potential opportunity?
Fantastic area. I mean, when we bought these companies, they were already trading down 50%. And last time I came on was probably a week after the U.S. downgraded the U.S. debt was downgraded by S&P. So all risk assets has gotten crushed. But some of these stocks, if you look at, and I'll throw a name out there, Pacific Biosciences, fantastic. It's trading near its cash value. It actually has revenue, which you don't really see a lot from biotech companies or speculative ones. And it's trading below its cash value with no debt. So it's almost you're looking at if you're looking for opportunity, there it is. You're looking at a lot of these life science companies. I think it's going to be amazing going forward. And I think the technology is there. Again, it's a risk asset. And if the market doesn't do good, these are going to get hammered. Yep. Like you saw in the summertime.
Yeah.
But the market goes up, they're probably going to easily outperform the market. But it's a fantastic growth story. One of the only ones I really like in biotech right now.
Yeah, a lot of risk in the biotechs and all that. Frank Curzio, Stansberry Research. I know you have a lot of different newsletters. You have the one under 10. You have your special granddaddy, big mama, like, wow. What's it called?
It's called Phase One Investor.
Phase one. Like a phaser. You know, this is sharply pointed but powerful. Anyway, yeah, you can get that. Get copies. I'm sure you have some samples that you give out. And you can check that out over at Stansberry Research. We'll have all the information on thedisciplinedinvestor.com on the website. We'll have that. Of course, we'll have – I need an updated picture of you. You got an updated picture? Because the one you have, you look – it's like just a head, no neck.
All right, yeah, I'll send you one.
or we can Photoshop a neck in. I don't really
care. I'll do what everybody else does. I'll send you a picture from when I was 21.
Nice. Nice. And, by the way, how's the baby?
Very good. Both babies are doing good. Yeah, both of my daughters are doing great. And, yeah, keeps you busy, you know?
I hear you. My two are in college. I was learning the fine art of beer compression, full can at a time. And I didn't do it. I was watching. I was amazed. Spiked with rum. In a 3-second blast, pressurized blast into your mouth.
It's amazing. I didn't do that when I was younger. I could only drink like slower. It's amazing how quick these kids drink these days.
But it comes up just as fast. I watched him do it, and honestly, 3 seconds later, I go, you know, you're not looking so good, you know, and he like pukes everywhere.
And isn't it nice because he'll puke and then he'll go
right
drink
back.
It again and wake up like 8 o'clock.
Well, the problem is he was a pledge. So what happened was all the guys said, you puked in front of a parent, and they went like bananas on the guy. You know what I'm saying? It was great.
It was great.
Frank Curzio, thanks for joining us on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Appreciate it, buddy. Bye-bye.
Thanks, bud.
So as I promised, next up, Michael Rosenberg. He's from Bloomberg, and he is a foreign exchange analyst, FX, you know, kind of currencies, and does a lot of work in the area of analyzing all the, we'll call it the risk of countries, et cetera. Put together some unbelievable areas and special, I guess it would be, we call it financial conditions watch for the area of not only the United States, but Europe and all that. Michael, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks.
So let's talk a little bit. You sent me this great presentation that you recently did, and you talked about the U.S. economic outlook. I want to just ask you a question first, something that's been kind of, I guess, bugging me a little bit. You know the 3-month euro-dollar swap, you know, EUBSC? You know, there's been a lot of discussion about this. And for those that don't know, it's kind of, well, let's just say it's one of the risk areas you look at to see what the lending conditions are like, the fear about lending out euros versus dollars. And you can correct me if more technically. But there's this range, and it's been like this negative 100 range. And a couple of days ago, it went to negative 118. So are we seeing any let up in the fear?
I don't think so. We seem to be bouncing from day to day with new rumors of what's going on in Europe. But what you really have in Europe right now is significant financial stress. Our own European Financial Conditions Index is 4 standard deviations below normal. What it indicates is that banks don't trust other banks. A lot of banks have a lot of European debt and therefore may take on large losses. So what we have is a situation where banks are sort of reluctant to lend to other banks. So you see some widening out in a lot of conventional spreads within Europe. And what it's also forcing is a lot of banks with excess funds to deposit them with the ECB rather than lend them out in the interbank market.
Hmm. So tell me about your overall economic outlook and tie that in, because I know there's a lot of Forex and currency movement that's really affecting things. What is the general U.S. outlook, and how does it, I guess, tie into Europe, and how does that whole thing work?
Right now, we live in a world where financial markets are linked globally. And so what happens in Europe feeds through and with spillover effects onto the U.S. financial markets. And that's pretty much what we're seeing right now. The financial stress in Europe, which is leading to significantly wider spreads, declining markets in Europe, has had that spillover effect onto the U.S., which has led to a deterioration in U.S. financial conditions. The Bloomberg Financial Conditions Index for the U.S. is now around 1 standard deviation below normal.
Mm-hmm.
That's broadly consistent with U.S. economic growth of around 1% per annum. So although I don't see right now the chance of an outright recession in the United States, the fact is that the negative spillover effects of the European financial stress on our market here in the U.S. is going to dampen U.S. growth prospects. That's why I think the Fed moved towards a more aggressive stance by one, indicating that they're going to keep the Fed funds rate unchanged for the next 2 years, and at the same time engaged in an Operation Twist policy to try to lower longer-term rates to offset the stress coming from Europe.
Yeah, I mean, what I read or listened to, by the way, the Bloomberg TV app, I don't know if I talked about that yet. Boy, that, do you have that for the iPad? Woo!
That is
more than unbelievable. Seriously, for the live TV especially, it's high def.
Yeah,
that is,
oh, really?
That is impressive. Anyway, but you know what? I think that we can go so far as the undertone of Bernanke's speech was all about, number one, yes, we will make more money available. Yes, we will make more money available. Yes, we will make more money available. The commentary that he'll go past 2013 if needed was interesting. And that one sentence where, hey, okay, so you don't get income from investing in banks and things like that. You should go out and invest in the growth of the economy. That was like, whoa. Was there a green light just pressed somewhere? You know, that was a risk asset green light button, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, he can't determine, how investors are going to allocate funds to the U.S. equity market. The U.S. equity market has rebounded from the lows, which is a good sign. In fact, when we look at year-to-date numbers, Europe is down and the U.S. is slightly up. But overall, the Fed is trying as much as possible to try to jumpstart the economy at a time when the Fed's own policy rate, the Fed funds rate, is at zero. So the Fed has to engage in unconventional measures, either through some communication that they intend to keep rates unchanged for the next 2 years, or engage in some form of what the Fed likes to call large-scale asset purchases, buying longer-term bonds to hopefully drive rates lower. If rates go low enough, then investors will say, I don't want to invest in such low-yielding markets. I'm going to put my money into more risky assets, such as stocks or commodities or what have you.
Yeah, but then we lead to some moral risk issues. Then we lead to over-leveraging. There's a lot of things.
Exactly. Right. So the Fed sort of caught between a rock and a hard place. I think that there are significant costs associated with these ultra-low interest rates that don't get a lot of press. One is that you've got a lot of pension plans that have liability targets. They need to generate enough income to meet future pension obligations. With rates this low, it's going to put pension funds at competitive problem in terms of being able to meet those long run obligations. And then you've got the people who are moving into retirement, the baby boom generation, who had planned on living off of their interest income, and not much interest income you can earn with yields at these levels.
Rocks a rock.
Right. There's a benefit to lower rates in terms of trying to stimulate demand, but at the same time, the demographics and pension obligations, et cetera, I'm hoping the people at the Fed are doing a cost-benefit analysis here of the long-run implications of these low rates.
Yeah, I hear you. Let's kind of skip over for a second, and then would you agree that the European economy, maybe looking forward, is potentially weaker? I'm talking about the whole Eurozone, weaker than the U.S. economy.
Oh, without question. Given that our own European Financial Conditions Index is now 4 standard deviations below normal, that is consistent with an outright recession for the European economy. If you look at the OECD's leading economic indicator for the European economy, that has turned down and is also pointing to an outright recession. Many of the business confidence indicators in Europe are all pointing to recession, and I believe even the new ECB head indicated the risk of an outright recession, and he just started this week. So basically, it's pretty much baked in the cake. That's why the ECB cut rates this week. They see the downturn, and it's clearly a concern whether or not a weaker growth in Europe could spill over to weaker growth here or elsewhere.
Well, they are the number one economy in the world. I don't think a lot of people know that. They still think that the U.S. is, but the Eurozone is the number one from a GDP standpoint total in the world. Right. So here's a question. Yeah, here's a question for you. So we agree that Super Mario cut rates this week by 0.25%, which was very brave of him, by the way, whether, make up all the stories we want about a gift being given by Trichet or whatever. All I know is I'm glad Trichet is out of there, although he supposedly is going to get the Banker of the Year award, or Decade award. But he was a twisting liar, in my opinion, but whatever. But Mario Draghi, the new ECB head who cut rates by a quarter percent was very interesting. It really rallied things over there. But here's the question. You cut the rate. We know that they're in a bad situation. They have all this risk going on with Greece, and the economy is slowing. Why in the world does that euro stay at the levels it's staying?
That's an interesting question. Bloomberg hosted an FX 2011 conference last week. We had Ken Rogoff, professor at Harvard and noted author. He basically asked the same question. He can't understand why the euro is as strong as it is. And I don't think a lot of people really have an answer to that. But the euro bounces around, but for the most part, really hasn't changed a heck of a lot. Some people argue, it's central bank reserve diversification, but we really don't have good data on that. The answer to your question is I don't think a lot of people know the answer to that.
Yeah, I mean, you can only speculate. Here's a speculation I have. Number one, first of all, I don't think the ECB, even though they want a strong euro, wants to really prop up the euro. That's not good for their exports. But aside from that, it seems to me the logical answer is, number one, risk trade, move it around, do what you got to do, a lot more currency traders. Number two, this may sound kind of crazy, but China and Asia are really, why not prop up the currency of the largest economy and their biggest trading partner so they can continue to buy things from them? That makes sense to me. Also makes sense for the U.S. to do the same thing in a way, to prop it up, you have that going on, and it can be because we know that currency manipulation has been a very important part of the government's initiatives these days, because we are in, frankly, a protectionism climate right now. But what about the yen? What the heck is going on there?
You know, Professor Rogoff asked the same thing.
Great.
Why should the yen be so strong?
Right.
But you're in good company, right? There are rather strange moves. I think with the yen, you have to trace it back to the Japanese investor base. Japanese investors tend to move their funds offshore, where they hopefully could get higher yields by investing in Australia or in some of the emerging markets where they can generate significant yield pickup, although they have 0% interest rates. When the Australian dollar weakened and some of the emerging market currencies weakened, they decided to bring their money back home, and that meant the demand for yen, and the yen has been firm as a result of Japanese households bringing their money back home. I would also add one other thing, and that is when we look at FX trader performance, and in fact, we even have a function on Bloomberg, FXTP, that allows individuals to, Bloomberg uses to track how currency traders are performing or how hedge funds are performing, and the performance has really been very poor in the last few years. And I think what's happening is that although people would argue the yen should be weaker, the euro should be weaker, I think a lot of people got burnt so many times trying to get that there that they kind of pulled back. So you don't have enough speculative capital to kind of drive currencies to where we think they should be.
Mike, one of the things I've always said is that because we had a lot of very strange market movement, you know, sometimes you might think, well, if currency guys that usually do it aren't making out, well, somebody else is. Well, that's not definitely always the case. But as I've said, it's like this. You haven't heard me say this, but my listeners have. You're in a rowboat on a river, and all of a sudden you're stuck. You need help. You can't move, right? Your health, you're doing that. You just need a little bit of a push, right? Well, out of the woods comes a giant elephant. And the elephant comes into the river, and you just hope for a little push, right? You're confident that the elephant could do this, right? The elephant decides they're not only going to give you a push, they're going to get in the rowboat with you. And you have a really bad situation in that the help ends up being so dramatic because they don't understand the weight of their heavy hand that you end up, whether it's sinking or just causing massive problems. And the government's interaction, just look at what happened when we know that over the last year or so that Japan has been actively buying REITs, equities, and ETFs through the open market in their particular stock market. The Japanese government is buying equities and looks like they may take a $500 billion loss on it, right?
Yeah.
It's massive. So even they can't hold up the markets, but yet they're artificially holding up because you've got to think about why is even the Nikkei so high. But let's go back to the financial conditions watch. You have a variety of different metrics there. And one of the things we looked at also is this whole European, the euro thing and why it's strong. And we talked, I think you and I talked about in an email, the whole idea of a possible repatriation and selling off U.S.-based loans and bringing euros back to help out if there is a ring fence required. But when we look at the financial conditions watch and we see a 4 standard deviation situation below, are we going to see a situation where there is a banking crisis there, or is it just enough money, do you think, involved in the EFSF to just keep everything at least status quo?
Well, I think there was a significant risk of a banking crisis. That's why European Financial Stability Facility was expanded with the purpose of trying to provide sort of a buffer against some other banks or other entities in danger of defaulting. We already had the situation with Dexia, the bank in Belgium. With the 50% haircut that the bondholders are going to have to take on their Greek bond holdings, there's going to be some concern about whether some Greek banks are in trouble because a lot of Greek banks had large exposure to that debt. Moreover, a lot of households had exposure to that debt. Not a lot of that's spoken about, but you were just an individual in Greece and holding on to Greek debt, thinking that you had a risk-free asset. Well, guess what? You didn't. But the you know, in the end, the risks to the banks are quite significant. One, in terms of, you know, their exposure to Greek debt or other peripheral bond debt. But there are other things that I think need to be looked at more closely. The European policymakers are intending to have banks raise more capital in order to meet their the new BIS guidelines on capital ratios. A lot of banks don't have enough capital right now to absorb another hit. But if banks have to raise more capital in today's marketplace, it's going to be difficult. So there may be pressure on banks to call in loans and maybe refrain from engaging in any form of risky lending of any form. And that means that banks may be contracting credit as a result of measures designed to get banks to raise their capital ratios. So although we may not have a banking crisis on our hands, we may have a new, even modest or perhaps more than modest, credit crunch as banks are trying to adjust their balance sheets.
Yeah, but with the way they're adjusting it already, Michael, the way they're adjusting it already is by changing maybe from the preferred to common. They're also looking to just to count certain things in. I mean, honestly, you know, some of the things that are going on with the EFSF when they talked about their leveraging and that, you know, behind the scenes, they're really double counting on some money they already lent out, and how on the banking capital ratios and the Basel III requirements, they're going to require certain things. And one of the things is the capital ratios. And you know, already they're using accounting tricks to raise their capital ratios. And it's kind of like what happened a few years ago when the General Accepted Accounting Principles not FASB, who was that? Was it FASB. The FASB rules changed when it allowed for a different view of the...
Right, yes.
I mean, it's like, wait a minute, let me get this straight.
They didn't have to mark to market here.
You don't have to mark to market. So you know what, just mark to whatever you think it's worth, and at least we feel better about everything. So this way we don't have a panic, and, you know, do smart investors... No. And I'm not saying this about anybody, but dumb investors then go invest because that's what they want. And that then brings up the stock price, which drags everybody else in. You know, right. And this is kind of the games that are being played. And it seems to me that the last straw was what Pompadreou pulled with this referendum crap out of the blue, by the way, after a deal was already struck. And I mean, I got to tell you something. That was nasty.
Yep.
And you called the question everything there.
Right. The market reads through a lot of that. What's interesting, I mean, not only is the European equity markets down and down pretty big so far this year, but if you look at bank share prices have fallen much more than the overall market has. So therefore, the ratio of bank share prices to the overall market is down, I think, to levels at or even below where we were during the height of the Lehman.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. SocGen is in bad shape. The French banks are the worst. So what do you think, you know, the big issue that I've talked to people about is my concern about France and the potential for a downgrade there. I believe, and I know this sounds, again, a little bit conspiratorial, but I believe that there is a massive fear, even by the rating services, to drop the rating on France, which clearly has a much worse situation overall than the U.S. has, and they dropped us here. But because if they do so, that puts into question the entire EFSF, and you may really see a massive run of the banks and a collapse of France. Thoughts?
Well, there's actually pressure within Europe to prevent rating agencies from rating sovereigns.
Right.
That probably answers your question right there.
Isn't that amazing? Amazing? You don't like the rule, so just avoid it. I mean, that's just if companies did what sovereigns did, you realize there would be SEC investigations and a lot of people out of business and in jail, right?
Yeah. Well, I think that in the end, France and Germany are trying their best to try to make a bad situation look better. They're trying to prevent what could be a more serious financial problem. That's why you know, the whole reaction to the Greek referendum, thankfully, at least that's been put off.
As of now.
their hands are tied.
Yeah.
And therefore, there really aren't a lot of textbook answers to a lot of these problems. The only things we have to go by is how emerging market countries have to deal with these crises. But, you know, those countries didn't have the kinds of deep financial markets that ours has.
Yeah.
That's what makes this harder.
Yeah, last point, number one, I think this really puts a truism to the phrase lipstick on the pigs. I think that really comes to play of what Germany and France are trying to do there. I guess in the end is, this big question that surrounds a lot of people about buying gold and silver and hard assets, about the U.S. dollar. You know, I think I've sent you some of the work that I did and kind of changed a few things to update some of the data through Bloomberg of what the different measure of what a currency should be viewed by or instead of a cross-currency comparison, using London Bank, Bank of England's, export, not the export rated, currency measure of the dollar or of the euro of whatever.
They have real effective exchange rate.
Yeah, and that's interesting because when you look at a couple of standard deviations, I mean, the dollar has been just on a rundown. It's not the lowest it's ever been in terms of, off of the standard deviations or Bollinger Bands, if you want to look at it that way. But is the dollar going to eventually just go kaput like a lot of people think and just, or is this just silly?
I don't think the dollar is going to go kaput. For as long as I've been in this business, and it's, over 30 years, there's always been talk, that investors were going to diversify out of the dollar and that other currencies would come into play. The dollar is still supreme, and it's going to be supreme for a long time to come. I mean, people talk about the renminbi coming in and rivaling the dollar at some point. It may come, but it's going to be beyond our lifetimes. Right now, on my measure, and you could actually run this on Bloomberg just going PPP, which stands for purchasing power parity, but the dollar is significantly undervalued against just about every major currency and by a substantial amount. So what that means is for European individuals coming to visit here, the U.S. is cheap, and for us to go overseas, it's expensive just to buy anything. But the dollar is very cheap right now, and if you are a valuation investor, and it's very hard to be a valuation investor in these kind of markets, given the volatility. But on a valuation basis, the dollar is actually a very attractive currency right now.
Yeah, I'm looking at that right now on Bloomberg, and I'll try to snag that and put it on our website so people can see it. Basically it's undervalued significantly, the most according to the Australian dollar, but also the least with the Swedish krona. It's undervalued by about 33% by the Australian dollar, New Zealand.
By 3%.
3% on the krona, yeah. So I guess in closing, I mean, you have such great things that you sent me. I hope I'm going to ask you if you can use some of this on the site so people can see this. I love that transmission of uncertainty. I love that. It's just a great piece in terms of showing what's happening. In terms of the last thing I want to kind of, touch on is in your 30 years being in currency markets, and there's been some times, don't get me wrong, there's been some times, obviously, that we've seen some real wacko moves on currencies that were real more, I think, focused on countries and economics. Have you ever seen currencies move as much as they've been moving?
I mean, actually, if you really look at the movements today versus where we've been, like, say, in the 1980s, this is nothing.
But
despite the fact that the FX market is at the center of a lot of what's going on, it's strange, but within the center, it's fairly stable. Your dollar exchange rate isn't doing anything. And if you look at the equity market moves, we go 100 points a day, and even that's small. But your dollar has pretty much been a range trade. The yen has been strong, but when you factor in yields into the equation, the yen has not been that great a performing asset. From like 1995 through 2007, the yen underperformed the dollar by a very large amount. Mm. but it showed up more on the interest rate, cumulative interest rate spread, rather than on the exchange rate. But no, I'd say exchange rates are actually, you know, they're not a source of strength or weakness for an investor. It's the yields that have been the more important driver of returns.
You know, I know that you have these at your. I wouldn't usually ask people to do these kind of things because it would take time. But I know Michael has this kind of stuff at his fingertips. It would be really kind of cool to look at maybe a rolling 1 year or whatever period volatility or range based volatility of, let's say, currencies for the last 20 years.
Right.
I'm sure you've probably done it, right?
Yeah. Right. In fact, if anything, markets are you know. You're getting less large swings than we used to get. And what that has meant is that momentum traders don't have as many big swings to jump aboard and ride that they used to. So they get stopped out more often than not. And in fact, the academic research has shown that technical models, momentum models, for the major trade, for the major currencies, momentum models no longer make money.
Yeah.
They used to make money hand over fist in the 80s and the 90s, but the magnitude of the moves are not as great. You just run a chart of, say, you know, the DXY from 1980 to the present, and you could see it clearly. I mean, we had huge moves. I mean, the dollar would go from 170 to 340 against the Deutschmark and then back down again. We're not getting anything like that in today's market. It seems like the FX markets are the center, but it's strange. The center is not moving anywhere near as much as the peripheral, where you see the you know Greek spreads against Germany going you know surging, equity markets moving a lot, commodity markets moving a lot, but the FX market itself, despite it being at the center of a storm, it's sort of like the eye of the storm is usually the calmer. You know, part, and that's, you know, and that's kind of, you know, where things are not moving anywhere near as much as they
I hear. And for those people out there that don't have Bloomberg, that you don't have the professional, you go to Bloomberg.com, and they have all sorts of great things there. Although, I must tell you, Michael, I'm sorry, don't answer, okay? I hate the new webpage. I don't know where anything is. You know, the new basic webs, I'm not used to the whole thing. I don't know if I can get used to the whole thing. But anyway, you go to Bloomberg, and they have all the currency information right there. I don't know if there is a function, Michael, maybe you can either lead me to it, or you can tell me if there's a spreadsheet available, to see the historical volatility. I'd love to see it like in a, you know, I guess a simple above or below zero standard deviation kind of concept over on a rolling basis. Maybe there's somewhere to do it. We'll talk about that offline.
I think you may be able to do it. You go to go to WCRS.
I got to write these down. Okay, WCRS, yep.
Yeah, and then on the left, this is a ranking. And then you to the left, you could see the returns, interest rates, and then volatility.
Mm.
Click on volatility, and you can track different
currencies.
Different currencies, and where the volatilities are. So if we want to look at historical volatility, you could look at different currencies.
Yeah, I'll do that. Cool. And then we'll talk a little bit. I'd like to put a couple of these slides on the website, but we'll talk what's available and what's not. Michael Rosenberg from Bloomberg, he writes on and does analysis, great stuff on financial conditions, Forex, global analysis, and all that. I really appreciate you coming on and spending some time with us today.
My pleasure.
All right, have a great day. Thanks, Michael. Bye-bye. All right, with that, now we're all going to remember that we're not going to panic about the news. We're not going to get crazy about what's going on. And we're going to stay nice and calm, right? Nice and calm. We're going to put the news to the side, and then what we're going to do is simply just watch the trends of the markets. So that's all that it's going to be. It's just the trends of the market and then the trends of the stock, and work with that right now, because that's going to be our best, you know, the best divining rod when it comes to what's going on right now. That doesn't mean it's going to be straight. It's going to be a direct route, but use the trends as your friend, as they say. Not to get too hokey here. Again, next week we're going to be here with some great guests, Tom McClellan and Das. If you have any questions for Das or Tom, you know what? You could always write me too. Send it in and we'll try to get it on the air with them. send it to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Until next week, have a great and a profitable week. See you then. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.